Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Well, the section that I've been reading from is a scary section. Description of adverse fruitive activities. Canto 3, chapter 30. Death and meeting Nyamadutas. That's that section. Well, let's see. For sure, I'll read text 18, and we'll see, maybe go over a little bit beyond 18. There are three or four sections in the Bhagavatam that are particularly insightful, intimidating, scary. You know, the reality of material existence with its mindless thought consciousness. The 12th canto describing the advanced stages of the age of Kali, very sobering. The end of the fifth canto, description of hellish planets, very scary. The description of King Paranjana, when the city of King Paranjana falls apart, and it's an allegory of an attached person. And here, more explicitly, about, you know, a real life situation is, present life situation is, a classic materialist. And what their life of fruitive activities is like, and when, what happens as a result. The previous two chapters, they're very delightful. They're descriptions of devotional service, explanation of devotional service and pure devotional service, and it's filled with light. There's the end of the previous chapter is 10 verses in a row speaking about time. Starting with, you know, the propensity of service to the Supreme is eternally situated within each and every living being, misplaced due to forgetfulness, and then one becomes servant of other things besides servant of the Supreme, and then one comes under the influence of the time energy, because then the time energy brings into being all those objects and illusory relationships that one becomes attached to, and then time takes those things away, and one is bereft in great sadness that, oh, my possessions and my happiness is gone. One comes under the influence of the time energy. And that there's small circles and bigger circles, that time energy brings the whole creation into being, along with its various forms of life and everything that people become attached to. I recognize that voice. So to speak. Okay. So with that illusory feature of the time energy material life begins and activities are performed, because you need time for activities to be performed. And then the nature of attachment to lists of things to which one becomes attached, and family and home and paraphernalia and obsessiveness for those things. And so the lifespan of someone who lives like that is described in very graphic detail. And then towards the end of life, slowly or rapidly things slip away or are abruptly taken away. And it is a description of time energy brings one to the stage of expiration or death. And because all the person has known is those temporary things, they're panicked. And the functions of the body break down, and the coughing and this and that, and the relatives come. Anyway. Thus the unfortunate man, unsuccessful in maintaining his family members, is bereft of all beauty. He always thinks of his failure, grieving very deeply. Seeing him unable to support them, his wife and others do not, this is old age, do not treat him with the same respect as before, even as miserly farmers do not accord the same treatment to their old and worn out oxen. The foolish family man does not become averse to family life, although he is maintained by those whom he once maintained. Deformed by the influence of old age, he prepares himself to meet ultimate death. Afflicted by many illnesses, he eats only very little, small morsels of food. He becomes an invalid who cannot work anymore. And so on. Surrounded by relatives, they cry, "Oh, my father, oh, my friend, oh, my husband." He wants to speak, but he can no longer because he's under the control of time. Then this text 18. Thus, the man who engaged with uncontrolled senses in maintaining a family dies in great grief, seeing his relatives crying. He dies, most pathetically, in great pain and without consciousness. Report. In Bhagavad Gita it is said that at the time of death, one will be absorbed in the thoughts which he cultivated during his lifetime. A person who has no other idea than to properly maintain his family members must have family affairs in his last thoughts. That is the natural sequence for a common man. The common man does not know the destiny of his life. He is simply busy in his flash of life maintaining his family. At the last stage, no one is satisfied with how he has improved the family economic condition. Everyone thinks that he could not provide sufficiently because of his deep family affection. He forgets his main duty of controlling the senses and improving his spiritual consciousness. Sometimes a dying man entrusts the family affairs to either his son or some relative, saying, "I am going please look after the family. He does not know where he is going. But, even at the time of death, he is anxious about how his family will be maintained. Sometimes it is seen that the dying man requests a physician to increase his life at least a few years so that the family maintenance plan which he has begun can be completed. These are the material diseases of the conditioned soul. He completely forgets his real engagement dash to become Krishna conscious and is always serious about planning to maintain his family, although he changes families one after another. The next several verses are seeing the Yamadutas. Refrain that appears even in the devotional service chapters and here in the adverse fruit of activities chapter is this, the feature of time. This keeps things moving. Feature that time manifests depends on guna and karma, but time is a devastating, invincible force. And a principle of yoga is control of the mind. One can't progress in any yoga discipline without control of the mind. And the mind is uncontrollable. Seemingly. Yet yoga is to control it. And one of the controls spoken of in the Bhagavatam many, many situations is dharma. Dharma is compared to ropes that are placed within the nostril of an oxen. And by a little tug on the rope, the big powerful animal goes left or goes right or stops or starts. Then eventually it's just a verbal command instead of pulling the rope. It's just saying the word and the animal understands the word. It moves. And the rope is placed through the nose because for the big powerful animal, the nose is very sensitive, and the little tongue this way, little tongue that way, the big lumbering body moves. They don't like the pain. Similarly, human society voluntarily, the language of the Bhagavatam, voluntarily places itself under the control of dharma. Because control of dharma means to be control of the creator of dharma, the personality of Godhead. One places oneself under the control of the personality of Godhead by regulating, the senses become controlled by regulation, by regulating activity. And the regulation is, in short period of time, is to reduce the influence of the lower modes of nature, elevate the quality of life towards the higher modes of nature, and just keep going and going and going, and ultimately the purpose of dharma is to connect in eternal loving service with the personality of Godhead. That's the ultimate objective. Connect again with the personality of Godhead. But even by the regulation of activities on this plane. So, the earlier parts of this chapter are describing both the regulated and the unregulated. Unregulated meaning sinful life, in violation of Dharma or neglect of Dharma. And that, so that leads to further degradation. And the section with the Yamadutas, that's the consequence of those that are engaged in sinful activities. If one is not engaged in sinful activities, one is not meet death by seeing the Yamadutas. But sinful life, Yamadutas means one is going down to the hellish planets. Not just anybody, everybody sees the Yamadutas. Persons that are, their destiny is a hellish suffering due to their sinful activities, the Yamadutas come. But even for the dharmic person who doesn't understand what's the purpose of Dharma, rather, that the more generic view of what is the purpose of Dharma is prosperity. And after this life, more prosperity. Heavenly enjoyment. So enjoy nicely and abundantly. And after this life, even more so. But Dharma is perceived as a tool or an instrument to get to that better enjoyment standard, commonly. And that's also binding. While one's senses may be regulated by the codes of Dharma, the mind continues to be agitated by the spirit of enjoyment, separate enjoyment. That's what agitates the mind. That discussion last night, the lady that's not from MIT, what's her name?
Kaya, I think.
Kalyani?
K-A-Y-A, Kaya.
Kaya, okay. She was very interested in Sanskrit terminology. She says, and one of the things I do is I'm an etymologist. So, just following that discussion, she was interested in hearing more about the word tattva, because she's heard of satya, and to her it sounded similar. How are they different? Because I said tattva means truth, so I thought satya or satyam means truth. So I'll connect it back with this. The root cause of suffering, so many times Prabhupada just said it very simply, didn't expand on it. The root cause of suffering is ignorance. And go more deeply or drill down a little bit on that, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says what's behind both sin and offense is tattva vibhrama. Ignorance of tattva, and he then delineates tattva meaning truths about eternal reality. And then he says there's four eternal reality truths. There's God, there's the devotional service in relation to God, there's the devotee who's engaged in that devotional service unto God, and there's the spark of life, chitkana, that's fully spiritual within this world. So within this world there's three tattvas, jiva tattva, vishnu tattva, you could say bhakti tattva, and nama tattva, Actually, that's the other one, the holy name. So, those things that are fully spiritual, if one, Vibrahma is not in knowledge of those tattvas, tattva Vibrahma, you're in ignorance. That's the standard of ignorance, is not understanding truth, eternal reality. So we went through this thing because she was asking, tat, like Om Tat Sat. Tat is a pronoun. It means that, like in the Upanishads, tat tavam asi. Tat, or in Gayatri mantra, tat. It's a pronoun. In the Upanishads, it's taken to mean Brahman. For a devotee, it means the personality of Godhead. Because the sunshine indicates the sun god. So, similarly, tat indicates transcendence, indicates the personality of Godhead, because from him, upon him, transcendence is resting. So in any case, tat means absolute truth, and tattva, this second one, tva, means having the quality of, or like, you know, hardness and softness. The word ness, hard, and there's hardness, soft and softness, dark and darkness. So tva is having the quality of whatever the other word is. Tat tva is having the quality of connected to transcendence. So tattva Vibrahma is not going about this world and not being in touch with or in knowledge of that which is fully spiritual. That's a materialist. They're tattva Vibrahma. They're in ignorance of spiritual reality. Tattva Vibrahma. And in that condition of tattva Vibrahma, you relate to, as this activity, excuse me, as this chapter describes, activity in pursuance of that which isn't reality or Maya. And a whole life is constructed, and, you know, in the course of a lifetime, revised and reshaped and reconsidered and reconfigured, because it didn't bring the happiness that one wants, because every living being by nature is also ananda, sat, chit ananda. So then we had this discussion, what is sat? Because there's sat and satya and sattva. Those are just the suffix. So sat means eternality, and sattva, like she knew the word sattvic foods. Sattva is having the quality of sat, having the quality of being eternal. And satyam or satya commonly is abiding by sat. So that's the conventional translation is truth, like sattva-gun, in the mode of goodness. In the mode of goodness, there's that which approaches closer to eternality, that is to say, the time factor is acting less, that which maintains. Then there's shuddha-sattva, there's no influence of time. Krishna's body is shuddha-sattva, or the holy name is shuddha-sattva. The soul in its intrinsic nature is shuddha-sattva, but the soul becomes covered. It's like a diamond covered by mud. The diamondness isn't changed because the diamond is covered by mud. just clear the lodge, and there, the diamond sparkles. Maybe add a little polishing, and the diamond sparkles, because that's what diamonds do. So souls do what souls do when, through dharma, sattva becomes more prominent, and then shuddha sattva, the quality of the soul, becomes fully operative. So there's a way to pass through all these things that are described in this chapter, the adverse fruit of activities thing, that the solution is not become a mayavadi. The mayavadi doctrine, at least Shankaracharya's version, says if you want to make spiritual advancement, you have to take sannyas. Karma sannyas. The whole message of those first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita is no, not karma sannyas, karma palatyag. Become detached from the pala of your activity. But the adverse fruit of activities is, whether dharmic or adharmic, be attached to the fruit. Try to be the enjoyer of the fruit. This minus the karma yoga principle of you offer the fruit to the Supreme. So even persons that follow karma kanda, do the rituals and so forth, there's this affinity for enjoying the temporary. And it has these, going back to, now to the verse, the affinity for enjoying the temporary, if that's what one's life has been made up of, that's where the thoughts go at the time of death. And that's going to carry the soul via the subtle body. The mind portion of the subtle body is the thinking, feeling, and willing part. False ego is, you know, misidentification with all of that. Even in a dream, we think that's me. Whatever it is. Because false ego, the mind is not fully functioning. This is described in the 11th canto of Bhagavatam. It's very interesting. There's sleep, awake, sleep, and deep sleep. And awake, the whole machine is operating. False ego, material mind, material intelligence, we're busy analyzing things. The mind is filled with thoughts and desires, and false ego is running the show. Then, when there's sleep, the external senses, of which the mind is, the internal sense of mind is chief, becomes quiet. The mind is still going in dreams, but this sense perception, for example, it is less. For example, you can lie down on your left side and wake up in the morning and you're on your right side and you don't remember rolling over, because the senses are, and one sense is still somewhat operative, the hearing sense, but otherwise the senses and the mind and the ability to analyze things in dreams state is very weak. It's there. The Karapajana Muni describes it's somehow attached or subtly attached to the false ego, and we think that's me, whatever that thing is in the dream. False ego doesn't go to sleep. And time acts differently in sleep. Moments can be like, you know, a whole long series of events, disconnected, scattered, etc. But time is acting. So these it's really fascinating. These are elements that are being used or under the supervision of Supersoul to allow the living entity this illusory existence that he wanted, to try to be the enjoyer. So even when you're asleep, you're trying to be the enjoyer. And those without the controlled mind, that is, the controlled mind means directing the mind to transcendence or to tat, to Satchit Ananda Vigraha, to the Supreme Truth. If one has done that during one's life, that's where the attention goes, and it's what we cultivate. It's an operative free will choice. We can choose that or not, or weak, or a little stronger, or, you know, and then sustain that, or to sustain that over time depends on the light that's inside that says, I really want to be in my relationship with Krishna. For us, you know, that's the devote, the bhakti message. And I know I can't achieve it on my own. I'm reliant upon the mercy of Krishna to help me, but I want to be in that relationship. So if that's the alternative to chapter 30, adverse fruit of activities. But if by default one has not done that, then it's the adverse fruit of activities program. In different intensities or different degrees of severity, and in the course of the chapter, sometimes it's later, sometimes lesser, sometimes greater degrees of severity. But it's what the technique that's being used, as far as I understand, an educational technique. It's compare and contrast, and this is what devotional service is, and this is what devotional service isn't, or the life minus that operative bhakti principle that says I want to be in my relationship with Krishna. If that's absent, then it's life without, of the compare and contrast. Same model of education in much shorter form as in the first invocation and first three verses of Vishvapanishad. What's the complete whole? What's the life living in that complete wholeness? What's the benefit of living one's life that way? What's the consequence if you don't? Compare and contrast. A life of God-centered. Ishavasyam idam sarvam. God-centered life. Where one's still involved with the temporary, but not attached to it. One is, at one level, dutifully, and then another is transcendentally engaging in the temporary for the purpose of assisting one in that ultimate mission, connecting with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And the dharmic principles of life assist in that, provided we're aware of what that is, what the intention behind dharma is. And otherwise, it's another, you're lost in the endless cycle of birth and death. Because one isn't attached just to the personality of God, to transcendence, to ourselves, for that matter. Self-discovery isn't going to happen without God consciousness. Some other kind of discovery will take place, and we take that to be self-discovery. Very easy, or I should say, very common. Self-delusion is very common, and self-realization is very special. The human form of life is meant for that. And back to the message, part of the impetus of having us sit straight when we start to fall asleep or be inattentive or complacent is, here's consequences of when that is absent. And, you know, whether this is a perfect fit for every circumstance of a materialist or not, the principles are very clear. The Bhagavatam isn't just doing a scare tactic to get people, you know, to sit straight. It's They're elements or principles of materialistic life of forgetfulness of Krishna. And it's good to know that. like, you know, like anatomy class or something. Pull back the skin, what do you see? Part of modern Western culture is to make things look nice. Like, you know, packaging of meat or whatever. Make things look nice and put some perfume on it and a bow and a ribbon and make the call it a nice name. Somebody was describing to me over the weekend that they've been working for a company for 19 years and they were offered a package. Because the company wants to, you know, increase their profit margin. So they're going to shift people somewhere. You can go somewhere where it'll cost the company less. Doesn't matter about your kids in school and doesn't matter about your life. It's just profit margin. So if you don't want it, you know, you get a package. Anyway. So tomorrow we'll hear about the Yamadutas. Yes.
Maharaj, you were talking about the three tattvas, Jiva Tattva, Vishnu Tattva, and Nama Tattva.
Yeah.
So, how is Vishnu Tattva and Nama Tattva different? And I mean, they're both spiritual.
They're similar and they're different. Vishnu Tattva specifically is the truths about that category of the personality of Godhead and its different features, of course, Paramatma included. And Nama is not qualitatively different, but is a particular manifestation or form through sound. So there's the tattva about Nama, the form of transcendence through sound. Okay.
So Guru Maharaj, I've always wondered about the role of punishment in Krishna's system. So we always see, or we tend to see punishment and understand it as something that is done to correct behavior. But often it leaves a lasting scar in the psychology of individuals, and then it seems to defeat the purpose of the very act of punishment. So I'm sure this is more from a conditioned perspective how we view punishment. So how do we understand Krishna's use of it?
Yeah. Well, as a parent, I'm sure you can understand about the role of punishment, and it's restraining one who wants to enjoy in a way that's unwholesome or harmful to oneself or others is seen as a punishment from on the receiving end. But you know, your question is, how is Krishna using it? He uses it like you may use it as a loving parent. It's not meant as a loving parent to inflict senseless, non-comprehensible, you know, bad experience or misery. The purpose is for elevation. That's the higher, just like, you know, saying the question of punishment is just step back and say, why creation?
Mm.
There's a Chinese lady in Chicago that I was introduced to at Rath Yatra some time ago, and she said, I have just one question. Why creation?
Mm.
because with creation comes objects that you aren't supposed to be in, to interact with in a certain way, and if you do, then there's punishment. So why tempt a child? Put objects around the child with rules that says you can't touch them. If you touch them, you're going to get punishment. What's the sense of that? Just take the objects away. So it has to do with the modes of nature and the kinds of covering that is awarded to the living entity because of the degree of darkness that they choose to move to. That's why creation. That there's the desire to enjoy independently is what's behind it. So it's the facility to enjoy independently, which the message from Krishna's side is there's no enjoyment there. But some persons want it anyways, it's like a criminal. So then there's punishment for the crime. So why even, why even allow creation? Why even allow the opportunity to do criminal things, things that are in darkness that lead to further darkness? The free will of the living entity. So Krishna desires, go back, it's in the third canto, chapter 5 or 6, where Mahavishnu is in his Susupti state, the living entity, are in the Susupti state within the body of Mahavishnu. There's no cosmic manifestation. And that the prompt for the cosmic manifestation is, from Mahavishnu's side, he wishes those living entities to be able to experience the fullness of happiness. In that Susupti state, they're not. It's all suspended. That's his desire. And then things start to happen for the purpose of creation. Rama Devi sees his desire and she facilitates his desire through the agency of her shadow energy, Maya Devi or Chaya Devi, etc., etc., etc. The Krishna's purpose, your question, is to reform the living entity of that core desire to be the separate enjoyer. There is no separate enjoyment. And that what that means is even the punishment and the experience of being punished are Maya. Maya in the sense that it's no more, there's no substance there. The intent from Krishna's side is to reform the spirit, the spirit of the soul, or the inclination of the soul to be a separate enjoyer. He doesn't want creation. He doesn't want people to have objects that they interact with in an improper way and have to be punished. You've heard Prabhupada's example of the state creating a prison house. The state isn't rubbing its hands together saying, I can't wait until we get the state going and then we can prepare a prison house and put people in prison. But it's necessary. So a necessary part of the living entity's desire for separate enjoyment, which doesn't exist, part of that is a prison house. But part of the prison house is the enjoyment. Because that they chasing after that keeps them in ignorance of their relationship with Krishna. So they shouldn't have that either. The reward and the punishment. Should just have one thing. Kingdom of God, and forget creation. Then there's no free will. There's only one thing. you have free will, but there's only one choice. So go ahead, take your free will choice. It's regrettable. The Supreme Personality of Godhead and the devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead that know the desire of the Supreme Lord don't want to see people suffering like Prahlad Maharaj. For me, I just remember you and everything is fine. Even if outside is horrible, punishment is coming for you. For me, the misfortune is all these other souls that don't understand what the place of shelter is. That gives me great pain. But it gives Krishna great pain that persons have to be both in the reward and the punishment side. The illusion of forgetfulness of their relationship with him for their sake of happiness, back to Mahavishnu with the living entities within his abdomen, wishing that they could experience the fullness of happiness. So the reward and the punishment both are part of that. But then, you know, the deeper message, depending upon, so it depends on the modes of nature. The deeper message is not, you know, on the reward side, don't be the enjoyer of the reward because you've done dharmic life. Rather, see it as a reminder or an encouragement facility for ultimate liberation. That's the purpose. And both sides.
And for it to be effective, it has to be inspired by purity? Is that
well, there has to be association of someone that has that sound, that has that consciousness and can create that, transfer that consciousness through sound. Sangha, sadhu sangha is essential. It's imperative to get the real purpose of life. So like that was the discussion from one of the discussions yesterday. Wow, that's really rare. The same lady saying, you know, I go off to Africa for 1 year doing what I do and I don't have any sangha of elevated souls. So what to do? So create it through sound vibration. It works.
Thank you.
The question that you asked, the way that you started it was, you know, something that I've often thought about is the position of or the role of punishment from the side of God. Now then, just living your life as a husband and as a father and whatever are the other roles that you have, is there how you do even the reward as well as the punishment side, how you live your life, how do you perform, you know, how you live your life, perform the roles that you perform in a way that the purpose behind it is right. Not just, I would like to be treated this way, so I do it. You know, that's a mode of goodness principle. Then there's the transcendental principle. That which will nurture and facilitate directly or create the atmosphere where it becomes possible to awaken God consciousness or Krishna consciousness. So a mode of goodness atmosphere is conducive. But that's not sufficient. It is also binding. It has to be with that higher principle. Of course, that higher principle is something you have to carry before you can give it.
Because I've heard that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, for example, doesn't use his weapons, but uses the holy name to transform.
But at the same time, you know, he you know, Chota Haridas. I don't want to see him again. for the rest of his life. Tell him to go away. No. He did some heavy things. Mm. And without, you know, other examples. His assistant that went off with the Bhattaharis.
Mm.
It was my duty to protect him. Now he's back. He can go wherever he likes, do whatever he wants. I don't want to see him again. When they're attached.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't mean-spirited. It was... and then, you know, in our lives, how practically to do those things, so much depends upon our Krishna consciousness. If we don't have the Krishna consciousness, we don't do those things.
Mm.
But sometimes, my experience is, even without understanding how Krishna is utilizing any one of us, not just me, sometimes Krishna is using us to help, you know, someone with some attachment to become aware of that attachment and attached to Krishna instead of that attachment. Anyway, a life of Krishna consciousness isn't going to come about just by complacency or by euphemistic altruism. It's going to come about by a deep desire for us to be in our relationship with Krishna. And then we can understand consciously how to do what would be most pleasing to Krishna. That's a conscious life. Krishna conscious life. Anything else?
Good news. Yeah? That brings up a parenting question.
Parenting question.
Yeah. So when the kids of this age, they expect like a lot of choices to be given, rather than to be said that do this, do that. So when you're giving choices, what kind of choices should you be giving? Is it like it's all diverting towards Krishna consciousness, or you give a mix of choices and guide them to choose something that is favorable to Krishna consciousness?
Depends on the child, and depends on you, and depends on the circumstance. Guiding is most. It takes the most time. So like, why do we as a family, so like, you know, having the sense of connectedness amongst the family members, children included, is, you know, we, not us and you, but we. But why do we as a family choose to do this and to not do that? Like, I just got this yesterday, I got an email from a young boy that now living in Chennai. He just turned 13, and he was expecting a birthday present. And he told me, in his letter, he wrote this: I was expecting some kind of he used its acronym, PBM or something, a game toy. And my parents said no. And I understand why they said no. But I'm still attached to having that game toy. What do I do? So I gave an answer, but you know, as a parent, why do we? It's a little bit like what this chapter of the Bhagavatam is doing. You know, let's go down the path of how people will live their lives that way. What's it like? Let's just imagine we don't have Dharma. We just like anything goes. Let's go down that path a bit. What's going to happen? What's the quality of that life like? You know, it depends on the circumstance of the child and the age and things. But why? And when there's comprehension of the why, then it makes it easier. So, besides the two options that you gave, there's probably multiple other options than restricting the choices or just giving a, you know, giving a wider range of choices and helping to guide to make the right choices. Probably a whole lot of other options besides those two. The first and foremost is the sense of love. A family that feels loved. And not in the worldly sense, but in a transcendental sense that carries itself out through the worldly sense. But behind the worldly embrace of the child is the sense of it's not just an attachment, it's a deeper sense. So that has to be something that you as a parent carry. So work on that one. And then when it comes to the idea of freedom, it's expanded beyond the family, and it's sociology. Is there greater happiness because there's more freedom? And decades of studies have shown no. With prosperity, with economic prosperity, then one has the economic facility for more choices. Does more choices lead to greater happiness? No. Does it lead to greater frustration and depression and anxiety? Yes. And it's true for any culture. I've had this discussion with some young people in China. Do you think China would... Question. 30 years ago China and 30 in today China. Are people, is the quality of life better? Are people happier? They have more stuff. Are they happier? You don't even have the proper air to breathe. And it's not just Beijing. It's all over the place. Anyway, without... So to help the child, that as the child grows beyond the purview of the family, and now in their teenage and young adult and adult life, why do we make the choices that we make? Because it's just restricting choices. Anyway, why do we live the life the way that we live? Why is this the basis of a loving relationship between parent and child, or a family member and family member? Let us together do things that are wholesome and meaningful. It may just, go to a park, or go to something. Go do something together. It's awesome.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I have one question. Like you talked about the adverse effect of fruitive desires what the jivas have. So, there are many devotees like Dhruva Maharaj, so he went and... when Krishna appears, he does not have any fruitive desires, and still Krishna fulfills the material desire what Dhruva Maharaj had. So how do we understand Krishna fulfilling devotee's material desire, and there are someone who has a fruitive desire himself, and that is binding. And it gives adverse effect, and Yamaduta is coming, his consciousness is getting polluted. So how do we understand that?
Well, specific for Dhruva, the Lord had a plan for Dhruva. When Dhruva got to the point where he no longer had that desire for that kingdom, that kingdom that he was, immaturely desiring was the spiritual world. What he wanted was not his father's kingdom, but better than his father's father's father. That's spiritual world. So he was given a position in the spiritual world. He however, was told by Lord Vishnu that you go back and become, you know, because the kingdom needs a king. And you're a qualified king, so you become the qualified king and rule the world for whatever the number of years, 60,000 years or something. Satyuga. So that's unique, where you become free from material desire and the strength of bhakti, and then you get the material desire fulfilled. He didn't preside over the kingdom as an enjoyer of the kingdom, as a materialist would be the enjoyer of ruling a kingdom. He didn't in pure Krishna consciousness. And so without the details of what the Lord's plan was, the Lord had a plan for him, including being a Krishna conscious king, pure devotee king for 60,000 years, because it's Satyuga and he wants to proliferate Krishna consciousness or God consciousness within the citizens in Satyuga. So it could have been something else, or could have been somebody something else's, but that was his plan for Dhruva. And then for us, on the stage that Lord Chaitanya speaks about, you can do with it what you like. And that, I just want to be in your service. That's a high position. But when one aspires for that high position, and when attains that high position, you mean it. You can do with it whatever you like. And that's nice, to be in that position of doing whatever Krishna wants, whatever he likes. Or you just be his instrument. But that's not karma anymore, or fulfillment of material desire anymore. It's whatever the Lord desires. And then there's our life between where we are now and getting there, and we strive to be the instrument. And sometimes I find being the instrument of Krishna can be awkward. Sometimes having to, you know, discern what Krishna wants in difficult situations, very complex situations. But then, you know, that's a privilege. Besides, it's perplexing. Then the onus on an instrument is to understand what Krishna wants, or intuitively, or somehow or other, just stay fixed in the spirit that I want to do what Krishna wants, regardless of, you know, my filters, my sensibilities. What is it? That desire has to be, as to advance, that desire must become stronger, 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 and the stronger, stronger desire gets tested or refined by yet further perplexing circumstances, is my experience. But the mission doesn't change. Let's be Krishna's instrument. What does Krishna want? Because sometimes these questions come for pure devotees. Why did they do this? Why did Grandfather Bhishma fight on the side of the Kauravas, and he's a pure devotee, etc. So, you know, those kinds of things. He has the capacity to know what Krishna wants. Or Krishna just controls him in such a way he does what Krishna wants. There's no question about, is he a pure devotee or not? He's a Mahajan. He's under the care of the internal potency, so now in the practice stage, or approaching that standard of always being in the internal potency, it's how much do we want to be in Krishna's service, in connected with him in his loving service throughout our life, in all the little, medium and big decisions we have to make. Well, Krishna will help us. But we have to show him that's what we want. It's nice. It's challenging, but you know, it's nice. Life of devotion. Anything else? You have something?
Maharaj, you were saying that in the family there should be the feeling of love. So I have experienced that, I mean, the flow of love in the family, definitely it has to be between the people who are living in the family. But I have found that unless I have a strong channel of receiving Krishna's love, the exchanges of give and take within the family also become beaten, and you know, the feelings of love also diminishes. So my question is, what is the prime source of that love that needs to be felt within the family?
Well, it's the prime source of that which nourishes bhakti. Hearing and chanting, sound vibration. Hearing and chanting. That's our, you know, that's Bhagavad Dharma. That's our primary source, connecting with Krishna, both scripturally and practically. So it's for you as a member of the family. You have a very important service to do. Quality, hearing, and chanting. So you can be a loving giver and receiver. And it starts with your relationship with Krishna. Through hearing and chanting. And then other expressions of bhakti. The other seven limbs of bhakti. Hearing and chanting. Quality as much as you can, and stay focused on that. Krishna will help. There will always be interruptions and distractions and things. Stay with it. That's the Krishna connection. That's what makes the transports ordinary life into transcendental life. Then you'll be able to, with that strong hearing and chanting, you'll be much more in a position to recognize how Krishna is giving his love in, you know, so many ways. Like that saying, you know, how much does he love me? Let me count the ways. It's a countless list. Because we're less than perfect, there are going to be times when not only our hearing and chanting is less than perfect, but our ability to receive, when we're doing the same hearing and chanting one time, it is another time. That's the conditioned part. That's our imperfection. Still, we stay with it because I will not budge an inch from the lotus feet of Krishna. And experiences are coming my way due to my past implication with the material energy. I'm getting an opportunity to become purified. That's a way of how we can perceive, quote, punishment. I'm getting what's going to make my connection with Krishna stronger. And if I've done some misdeeds, I'll take responsibility for those misdeeds. But I will not budge an inch from the lotus feet of Krishna. And the means to do so is the proper hearing and chanting. And of course, you know, association of others that can support our hearing and chanting activity. To create a loving network of others that we find nourishment in our hearing and chanting activity. In fact, I'm going to end. I brought a bunch of Mahaprasada with me. It's like, that's why my suitcase was so heavy. So I'm going to pass out some Mahaprasada. I heard the children downstairs made me more of Mahaprasada. Hare Krishna. Is that a bus? Tourist bus?
Express bus.
Express bus. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to get some Mahaprasada.
Thank you. Shri Rupa.